No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. We have a very special guest tonight, but first let me say hello to my co-host, Maria Sanchez. Maria, how are you doing? I assume that you're sheltering in place.
I am sheltering in place. I am baking like a fiend. I just got approval on my qualifying exam on Friday afternoon, which is a huge step getting to the PhD, and Dr. Phoenix knows what I'm talking about. Yeah. So it's been quite the week for me, and healthy as are my kids. We had a Zoom on Friday night, so all is well, and I had a very solitary Easter, and I know you were able to celebrate with your family. I'm envious.
Yeah, well, I must say it's been a big week for me. First of all, I volunteered as a tester for all of Mrs. Brown's baked goods. So I put on about 17 pounds.
Yep, and we're calling it the COVID-19, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm almost there. And then on top of that, my little nonprofit, which has been badgering the IRS for now 2 years, finally got accepted as tax exempt. So we're very happy about that.
Congratulations. That's huge. Congratulations.
Huge. We call them every week, and you know, but finally they succumbed to our pressure, and we're now a nonprofit. It's tax exempt.
So ordinarily, we're really thrilled to speak with our guests, and today is no exception, but I must admit I have so much trepidation about what Dr. Phoenix is going to say. And Dr. Phoenix, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us, and I just want to introduce you a little bit, that he is the Executive Director of the Center for Economic Research and Forecasting at California University. He's also faculty and teaches economic metrics and environmental economics in the master's program. And he is also on the Wall Street Journal Economic Forecast Survey, which is comprised of 60 economists throughout our country, and they point to 10 major economic indicators on a monthly basis. So Dr. Phoenix, thank you for being here. And the press release that was sent earlier is kind of horrifying, and I appreciate your time. And please give us perspective as where you got to this point in your life before you go into the details of the press release.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I want to start by saying I have a bone to pick with the two of you. We have not been able to get baking soda in a grocery store in Southern California for 3 weeks, and clearly it's because the two of you have been hoarding baking soda with all the baking going on. I've been wondering who bought it all.
That's definitely Maria.
Well, you know what?
We had stockpiled baking soda, Doctor, for many years.
In earnest in December last year, so I did have soda and powder and yeast and flours and sugars. So yesterday when I made my chocolate chip cookies, I had all the ingredients in my pantry. So, Dr. Phoenix, I'll be on the hunt.
So don't blame you, is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, Doctor, but I haven't gotten any of those chocolate chip cookies. So, yeah, I've got them on the picture too.
So will you give us, Dr. Phenup, a little bit of an idea about how it is that you do what you do before you go into the details about your press release from April 14th?
Yeah, most certainly, yeah. So I should start all this by saying I'm not a typical economist, so this is a second career for me. So out of high school, growing up in the Midwest, I went to art school, studied architecture and photography, eventually got a degree in photography, and then actually worked as a teacher for a number of years, as a sixth grade science teacher at a private school in the Los Angeles area, and believe it or not, was asked by another company to start a commercial rock climbing school, and I spent over a decade as a full-time professional climbing guide operating in the Santa Barbara area, mostly climbing on outdoor rock and seeing the incredible Central Coast landscape from the side of a wall. And it was through that that I built a relationship with an economist then at Stanford University who was a really important mentor named Roman, and who also helped me get into grad school. And then in my mid-30s, I went back to pursue my PhD, and I earned my PhD from the Bren School of Environmental Science and Management, studying environmental economics, and developed a specialty in environmental markets. The organization that I run actually runs a groundwater market on behalf of farmers in coastal California. And also what Bren really instilled in me was an acute interest in policy, that we can deal with numbers, but no individual number really means all that much. What matters is, you know, what can we do to make a difference? How do we use those numbers to tell a story and then to make a difference in people's lives? And then what are the policies that we can work on, again, to really try and make a difference and to create broadly shared prosperity? I had the tremendous privilege after leaving UC Santa Barbara and the Bren School of Environmental Science there, heading to California Lutheran University, where I now run the Center for Economic Research and Forecasting, as you mentioned. We are a nationally recognized forecast center. We participate in a number of national forecast surveys, as you mentioned, the Wall Street Journal, also the National Association of Business Economics. And we are fairly unconventional in our thinking, but we have a really, really excellent track record, especially since the Great Recession.
What does unconventional in your thinking mean?
For most of the decade following the Great Recession, we were actually we were below consensus in terms of our economic forecasting. So, participating in surveys like the National Association for Business Economics, you know, we were consistently below the average of all their forecasts. That also means we were consistently more accurate. In fact, 4 years ago, we were awarded an Outlook Award for being the second most accurate quarterly U.S. forecast in the United States, and it was because of our fairly pessimistic outlook. These days, we're unconventional in the sense that we really place a high emphasis on things like monetary policy. Very few people prior to the Fed's most recent interventions in the last month were talking about the role of monetary policy. Also, in the trade war, one of the things we've been tracking very closely is the response of business investment, that component of the county's GDP. So we sort of feel validated in some of the things that we've been emphasizing as we track the economy, again, just because although we've been sort of different than the consensus, we've been pretty accurate.
Well, let me ask you, Doctor, as somebody that gets payments from their IRA every month, I'm very concerned about the stock market. And we've seen the Dow Jones Industrial Average went up 705 points on Friday, but it's down about 17% from where it was on February 19th when it was 29,312. Now, I noticed in your press release that you said a lot of this violent fluctuation that we've seen, or at least some of it, is because of Federal Reserve policy, monetary policy. What do you mean by that? How has the Federal Reserve affected the stock market?
Well, so obviously, as market watchers, like you, the last month now, really, we are still recovering from a case of whiplash. As everybody knows, between February 19th and March 23rd, the market dropped 34%, ending the longest bull market in history. And then within a matter of days, there was a dramatic market reversal. In fact, the bull market only lasted 15 days, the shortest on record, by a very, very, very big difference from the second shortest. And then, of course, the market's up 28 or 29% since then. Now, there were not fundamental changes in the economy that happened around March 23rd as the market reversed and swung from massive losses to massive gains. And so that really reinforces our point of view, which is that right now the stock market and the value of various indexes are a poor indicator of economic fundamentals, right? In fact, those stock prices, we believe, are disconnected from fundamentals. They're driven by other things. And the primary driver that we see is the influence of the Federal Reserve. And I would highlight that this tremendous volatility that we have had recently didn't start with the coronavirus. In fact, if we go back to the end of 2018, we had another whiplash period like the one that we're enduring now. Around October 3rd, I believe it was, 2018, Chairman Powell announced that the Federal Reserve was going to move to unwind the extraordinary interventions that they undertook in 2008 and 2009. In those years, in response to the financial crisis, they did stuff that the Federal Reserve had never before contemplated. They did things that were poorly understood and that were meant to be temporary and unwound as quickly as possible. Fast forward more than 10 years, and those temporary interventions were still in place. And so in 2018, the Federal Reserve said, we're going to move to normalize monetary policy, interest rate policy. We're going to increase interest rates systematically over the next several quarters. They also mentioned that they were going to try and unwind some of the trillions of dollars of assets that they had been, that they had bought over the previous decade. And what's amazing is that simply saying we're going to unwind policy, these temporary interventions, and return to a normal policy regime caused the market to panic. Between October 3rd and December 24th of 2018, the market dropped 19.7%. In fact, if it had dropped another 0.3%, the bull market would have ended way back in 2018. And this was people, we believe, that were only in stocks because the Fed had held interest rates so low for so long. The reality is that safer investment instruments like treasuries were returning a rate that was very close to zero in real terms. And so that was driving people into riskier assets like stock. And the reality is that's what the Fed wanted to do. The Fed stated way back in 8, 9, 10, and 11 that they were holding interest rates low to drive people into stocks, and they achieved that. What's amazing, or really disconcerting to us, is that in December, the Fed reversed course. They said, oh, we didn't mean it. At the end of December, they started signaling that they were going to, that they were not going to unwind those extraordinary interventions. And, of course, the market reversed and was off to the races between December 2018 and the most recent stock market high in February. The market went up 40-some percent. And so it has been on this huge climb. And so that tells us that maybe as much as 20% of the investment dollars that are in the market shouldn't be there. They're not there because they are betting on the 12-month growth outlook for the U.S. They're there because you can't get a positive real return anywhere else. And so that's to say the volatility back in 2018, the most recent volatility, is not so much, we believe, the result of the coronavirus. It's really the result of the tremendous distortion that the Federal Reserve has created.
And was there a plan to unwind this that should have happened 10 plus years earlier, or was it just subject to whomever was running the Fed?
Well, so the idea was to unwind them as soon as possible. And we believe that they should have been doing that at the latest by about 2012. Now, you know, I should say I don't envy policymakers, especially as it relates to the coronavirus, but even in terms of the last decade, because, as you know, we were suffering a tremendous, a very anemic recovery from the Great Recession. Growth mm-hmm. was slow, and there was a number of periods, two different periods at least, where people were talking about a double-dip recession. Are we going to fall back into recession? And there was tremendous political pressure on the Federal Reserve to maintain these policies, to really try and keep the punch bowl spiked, so that the economy, they believe, would continue to grow. And so the reality is they didn't take the opportunity to unwind those when it was possible. And, of course, now we're already into the next recession, and unwinding some of those things is unthinkable right now.
So that leads us to the press release, which you state the United States has entered deep recession and that you and your partner, Dan Hamilton, predict a slow and painful recovery. So do you want to go through that with
sure,
us?
Sure, yeah. So we believe, I mean, we know this, right? Baking soda aside, you know, you don't have to go to the grocery store to know that we're experiencing a historic and life-changing event, and that the suspension of economic activity that we are all living and experiencing is absolutely breathtaking. And this, it is not too early to declare that the U.S. has entered a deep recession as a result, actually not so much as a result of coronavirus, but really as a result of the extraordinary policy responses intended to slow the disease. Data has already begun to arrive. The latest data point was this last Thursday when we learned that over the past month, 22 million people have applied for initial unemployment claims. To put that in perspective, a monthly list of 22 million new jobless claims is an all-time record breaker. In fact, it is more than 10 times the number of new jobless claims from the previous record set in 1982. So that's to say this is an economic event that we're experiencing that is on a totally different scale than anything that has ever occurred in almost all of our lifetimes. There are very few people living who have any reference point that compares to this. Now, given uncertainty about the disease, given uncertainty about the duration of the shelter-in-place and social distancing orders, as a forecasting house, what we did is we actually set out to create a range of scenarios. And so currently we have a baseline forecast and an optimistic scenario. What's been really shocking for us is that over the last 3 weeks, we've actually had to revise our scenarios three different times as more information became available. Originally, we started with a baseline and a pessimistic scenario, and three times now, the pessimistic scenario has become the baseline, and then we've had to create a new, more pessimistic outlook. And so where the forecast currently stands is that SURF is predicting a total decline of economic activity from the peak of activity in February to the trough, the depth of the coronavirus recession, of a 20%. So 20% of economic activity, we believe, is being shuttered as a result of shelter-in-place orders. And we expect 30 million jobs to be lost as a result of those shelter-in-place orders. Now, to put those numbers in comparison, you know, the Great Recession, we called it the Great Recession, right? This is, the Great Recession was a downturn so severe, you know, that it threatened the livelihood of millions of Americans, reordered people's lives and careers in many cases. The Great Recession, by comparison, only saw a peak-to-trough contraction of about 4% of total economic activity, 4% of GDP. We're anticipating 20% for this recession. Great Recession saw a loss of only 8.5 million jobs. We're talking about perhaps 30 million jobs with 22 million people already applying for unemployment claims. So plainly, there's no economic contraction that compares since World War II.
Well, you know, Doctor, you said about these range of scenarios. In your press release, you said that the different scenarios are based on the drivers are social distancing and sheltering in place. These are the economic drivers. And I find this very troubling because we seem to be at a point right now where we're trying to make the decision whether to open up the economy again or whether to stay restrained. And it seems to me that the medical professionals are telling us that it's the coronavirus that's going to decide what we do. It's the virus that dictates, not the economy. But as an economist, are you telling us that we really should be paying attention to the economics and that should enter into any decision we make on how quickly we try to get back to economic activity?
Absolutely. So I think we need to balance two different things. There's the transmission rate of the disease. There is the absolute necessity of preserving human life and not overwhelming the U.S. healthcare system. But there is also the necessity of managing the transmission rate of those economic impacts. In fact, with another big difference between this recession and the Great Recession is the Great Recession actually had impacts across almost every industry sector. Obviously, it hit the finance sector, real estate, tremendously hard. But there were impacts across every sector of the economy. And there were impacts felt across almost all income groups. But the reality is that what we've seen so far is that the economic impacts of this particular event are really concentrated among economically vulnerable people. So people in many cases, in low-wage sectors of the economy, families living paycheck to paycheck, small businesses that were, really struggling already to get by, and of course nonprofit organizations that are dependent on public funding and the generosity of private support. And so the transmission rate of those impacts is going to severely impact, in this case, fairly narrow segments. And I think we need to really keep that in mind. In the case of the small business situation, right, there have been efforts made to try and encourage small businesses to maintain employees on their payroll. And the reality is, if we don't end the shelter-in-place orders soon enough, those businesses, it won't matter how much support we provide. There are many small businesses that won't recover, and that means there will be a million Americans who don't have a job to go to when the shelter-in-place orders are lifted. And so I do think we have to balance those two things. And again, I don't envy policymakers. It's an incredibly difficult task, but I do really think it's important to keep in mind that shelter-in-place orders have already induced an economic contraction that is larger than anything most people alive have ever experienced.
Well, the challenge is, too, that it happened almost overnight, unlike the other recession kind of limped along in 08 and 09 with the bad loans going and et cetera and all that yep. other fallout. This just, boom, one day.
In fact, the Great Recession lasted 18 months. Now this is another, this is where we may be somewhat unconventional, is that there are a number of forecasting houses and there's a lot of policymakers who believe that the economy is like a light switch. We shut down 20% of economic activity almost instantaneously, and there's this, and I think it follows that some believe that we can just flip the switch and the economy will restart again. And that there will be this robust, what's called a V-shaped recovery. The economy will roar back to life in June or July or whenever we lift shelter-in-place orders. We are among the 45% of economists in the most recent Wall Street Journal economic forecasting survey who believe that that's not how the economy works, that you can shut it down very, very quickly, but you cannot start it back up rapidly. And so we're among the 45% who believe that we're in store for a U-shaped recovery where the economy will contract and then there will be a bottom that is potentially long and painful and that the economy will only recover over a very, very long time period. We believe we'll be living with the consequences of the shutdown for years to come.
So our governor, Matthew, since I'm in Los Angeles too, he said this week that it's not a light switch, it's a dimmer switch that we're going to toggle with back and forth, you know, made furtive steps, if you will, to do this, do that, and then, oop, we got to pull back because that didn't work, or we got too many hospitalizations, or whatever. So I don't know, as you keep saying about the policymakers, are they reaching out to you to find out what you have to say? Because this it's not just a moral decision, too. It's a health and wellness decision.
Sure. When I actually think the moral and the health are tied up with the economics, that those things can't entirely be separated. I guess what I really long for from policymakers is a clear definition of what the goal is. You know, when the shutdown began, we were shown over and over and over again these two graphs, you know, a graph showing the number of new cases of the virus. There was a horizontal line that was the capacity of the healthcare system, and we were told that we needed, and I believe that we did, we needed to shut down economic activity in order to flatten the curve so that the number of new cases never exceeded the capacity of the healthcare system, and that if we exceeded that capacity, more people would die, and obviously those deaths would be unnecessary and preventable. And so that was the rationale for the shutdown, and I believe it was very worthwhile. But it now looks like in almost every geographic region of the country that that we have flattened it enough that we are no longer at risk of overwhelming the healthcare system. It even appears that New York may be getting to a point where that risk is diminishing. And so by the original logic, that means that we should be thinking very earnestly about opening as much of the economy as we feasibly can without causing that curve to spike again. Mm-hmm. And I don't hear that as much in the discussions that we're having.
Well, you know, Doctor, you were talking about policy, but in your press release, you said that you thought that government intervention could do little to help the trillions of dollars that we put into stimulus already, and other government intervention wouldn't, you know, that's really not the answer. So what do we do from a policy perspective if we can't, if the intervention of the government isn't going to solve this?
Well, and one of the points we try and make in the report is that even thinking of the stimulus package as a stimulus package is really a misnomer. That, you know, during traditional economic downturns like the Great Recession, there's a collapse of demand. And what monetary and fiscal policymakers try to do is, again, stimulate consumption. They try and put money in the hands of consumers and employers to keep business going, to keep consumer demand up. And they try and stimulate the economy. In this case, this is not a collapse of demand. This is a collapse of supply. This is a government-imposed closure of a large section of the economy. And so putting money in the hands of consumers, traditional fiscal and monetary stimulus, aren't going to work the way that they have in previous recessions. We can't stimulate an economy that is under a government-imposed shutdown. Now, the components of the package that I think are really important, obviously, are the ones that are providing for the means, basic means, for people whose jobs have been shut down, who have been forced into unemployment because of the closure, small businesses that are struggling to get by. So there are components of this that are absolutely essential, but we can't think of this as a stimulus. Because that definition, the traditional definition, doesn't apply. The other one is that I have really strong concern. You know, there might be this, anyone who thinks that, well, we can just extend the closure until August, September, October, if we need to, and then we can provide enough money from the government to support individuals, families, and small businesses, I think really needs to come to grips with the fact that the debt burden that is being accumulated will slow economic growth for a generation if we really let it run wild. And so that's to say that the government is going to be constrained in what it wants to do in future years because of its own debt burden. It's also the case that small businesses and households that are burdened by debt will grow more slowly, will employ fewer people. And so to us, we really need to have a very candid discussion about what the health policy goals are of the closure and then how we open the economy as quickly as possible with those health outcomes, those health outcome goals in mind.
So what do you think of the latest policy coming out of the White House that we open up in these phases? Is this something that you think is advisable? That seems to me that phase one is really all we're doing right now. But we see that there are several states, including states with hot spots like Pennsylvania, that are due to open this week, this coming week. They want to release. Yep. So what do you think of that?
Texas announced that it would be opening parts of it. Yep. I'll even offer that, you know, they have modified restrictions even in Ventura County, California, where I live, slightly. And so I like this. I think where we've headed in the last week has been positive in the sense that the federal government seems to have yielded on the issue of whether it controls when to open the economy. And I really think we ought to be allowing states to try and see what happens. Especially states in regions where the transmission rate of the disease wasn't as high to begin with, states that don't have as many dense urban areas, you know, allow them to start opening, and then let's see what happens with the transmission rate of the disease. Let's revisit that curve that we've been targeting, that we targeted at the beginning, and then really follow their lead and see if and assess whether we need to hold shelter-in-place orders in other districts longer, or we can start to open up wider sections. So I welcome those changes that are being discussed. And again, I'm not being naive. I'm certainly not betting that that this will be without some hiccups along the way and some unintended consequences. But the idea is to evaluate as we go, assess the costs and the benefits, and sort of have a dynamic policy with the target of opening the economy as quick as possible.
Well, and the beauty about leaving it to states is that, like California, with our 40 million people, they might even make different restrictions per county. Like you were mentioning, sure. Ventura yeah. County opened up golf courses, and yeah. that's different than Los Angeles County, but that's because Ventura County has 13 deaths. So it makes sense to do it on a state-by-state basis because each state has its own particular challenges, and they can deal with that within their own state.
Yep. Yeah. And obviously, too, we really need to support political leaders in states that are undertaking this experiment because it does take political courage. You know, there's a natural tendency to be risk-averse. You know, I sort of have a suspicion that that policymakers are much more likely to be blamed for deaths from the coronavirus than they are for deaths or shattered livelihoods that result from the economic impacts. And so I think there's a natural tendency on the part of policymakers to be risk averse. And so that means that we have to step up and support political leaders as they do this really difficult balancing act.
Well, that's certainly true. I think that's absolutely true. As a politician, I can affirm that. But I also think that there's a great risk in expediency and political expediency, especially. So we have to be very careful. But let me ask you, I see that you said that job losses could be larger than the Great Depression. And we know, you know, if I remember correctly from Economics 204, that the United States came out of the Great Depression in large part, based on the Second World War. So sure. This is the question I have for you. Do we need to realign the economy the way we did then? General Motors turned from building cars to building tanks. Do we need to turn the economy around? And can we declare war, a world war, on something like climate change? I know you're an environmentalist. Can we get the world to cooperate on some major problem like climate change and readjust our industries as a way to help pull us out of this whole thing economically?
Well, so first of all, let me just correct our record on the Great Depression just a little bit. So it's really hard to compare the Great Depression to anything in the modern era. It is such a different economy. The amount of wealth accumulation that's happened, the amount of upward economic mobility that's available in the United States, the average level of educational attainment, you know, there's so many ways that this is just a fundamentally different economy. So it's hard to compare. You know, if we had a 25% unemployment rate today, you know, which was the peak unemployment rate during the Great Depression, would that mean that this contraction is of the same scale? It's actually hard to say. It's hard to directly compare those. But what we're forecasting is not quite as deep as the Great Depression. So we anticipate an unemployment rate of around 20% compared to 25% during the Great Depression. We're imagining a GDP decline of about 19%. Peak to trough, the total amount of economic activity during the Great Depression declined 27%. And again, the duration was unbelievable. 3.5 years that the economy was contracting with some ups and downs along the way. And so what we anticipate here is certainly not a contraction that deep or enduring. And so I wouldn't say that we are anticipating something as great as the Great Depression. But what I will say is simply that we think this is already an economic event unlike anything that we can compare to in the post-World War II era. In terms of what can we do to kickstart the economy, the only thing I struggle with in terms of the proposal you just made is that, you know, I just don't know how you command industry to go out and create, like, on the scale that a war realigns and reorders an economy, right, where it literally redirects the entire productive capacity of the United States. And so I really think, again, that's why the government is limited in its ability to overcome the impact, economic impacts, right? Really what the government can do is try and end the shutdown as quickly as feasible while achieving our public health policy goals, and then let the innovators get back to innovating.
And you know what, when I hear you say, Dr. Phinup, about the 25% unemployment rate during the Great Depression, and now we're talking 20%, so that's 5% difference, but think about how many more people that represents because of the growth in our population.
Yep.
And so I know you can look at numbers all kinds of different ways. To me, I'm just thinking about all those households, how many tens of millions that is. And that's the scariest part for me.
And I'm sure what you can relate to, too, you know, that the Great Recession had profound impacts in coastal California. I know very many families, who were successful people in the building trades, you know, small business owners that had operated for 20 years, and all of that was torn away by the Great Recession. You know, people whose careers were upended and had to, you know, start life over, in a sense, and people who had to leave coastal California, right? And so that was merely the Great Recession, right? This is an economic event on a different scale, and so. Yeah, I definitely, my heart breaks for all those that are impacted.
And when does it go, in your mind, from a recession to a depression?
Well, in this case, I would just say a depression is, I guess there's the old joke, a recession is when your neighbor loses her job, depression is when you lose your job. I really don't mean that as I don't mean depression as a technical economic definition. But I would add that, again, the economic event we're experiencing right now is in a very different category than the economic event that we experienced just 10 years ago or so, 2008, 2009.
And I'm curious too, how does this affect you as a human being? Like, I can pick and choose to pay attention to the news if I feel like it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
This is what you do.
What's interesting, you know, it's a little bit of a it's a surreal experience in the sense that I am incredibly fortunate. I live in a semi-rural part of coastal California. You know, I have hiking trails right outside my house that are still open during the closure. I have a garden and fruit trees, and I have all of a sudden have this amazing quality time with my wife and our two boys. My wife's a corporate businesswoman who's able to work from home and still do all of her business responsibilities from home. And so that's to say we are among the least impacted people I can think of in this event. And so it's weird on one hand. There's things that are actually really wonderful about being home with our family, the time that we have with them, the quality time. You know, we've ended baseball practice 7 days a week that we were attending, you know, practices and games, and suddenly we have just each other sitting across the table at meals. My wife and I, again, are able to do our jobs, and so on one hand, we have that, and on the other hand, I'm looking at economic data I never imagined, an economic event, the scale of which I never imagined, and so, so it's a strange experience, that juxtaposition, and it also just makes me feel incredibly blessed that, that I've been spared, that I've been so lucky through all this so far.
Well, doctor, I'm trapped in the house with my adult children, so I'm willing to make a deal with you. If you'll accept one of them, I'll throw in a lot of baking soda. Believe me, I'll throw in more baking soda than you can use in a lifetime. But let me ask you, Dr. Fauci tells us that the virus will dictate the path forward. If that's the medical indicator on how we should move, what is the economic indicators that will dictate how we should move? What are those economic indicators that when we see them, that will map out a course for us?
Well, so the trick here is that economic data arrives usually with a delay, right? And so we're already hearing, some of the data that's arriving with the highest frequency is the new unemployment insurance claims. But things like jobs data, we had a jobs report, the March jobs report, where the unemployment rate increased from 3.5 to 4.4%. But actually, that only covered jobs data through the week of March 12th, so halfway through the month. It missed most of the 22 million people that lost jobs during the last month. In fact, I think, as I recall, it was about 700,000 jobs that were reported lost during the from the most recent employer survey. And so, this is one of the challenges, is that daily we get updates on what the new confirmed number of cases of the disease is, what the number of deaths is, and the economic impacts, though, are arriving at a significant lag. In many cases, it's of a month or more. And so it is difficult, actually, to establish, okay, what are those key economic indicators? If we were targeting a particular number, we wouldn't even know about it until more than a month had passed. And that just highlights, I think, the complexity of the challenge that that policymakers are confronted with. In the case of the health policy goals, again, what I would like to hear is, you know, I would like to hear a clear articulation of what the public health policy goal is. Is it merely to flatten the curve enough that we work within the existing capacity of the healthcare system? Or is it something else, right? So what is it that we're targeting with these closures? because if it's the curve, then it feels like the experiment that's going to be undertaken here in the next few weeks in several states where they start to reopen parts of the economy is the appropriate step.
So does this lag in the data, the economic data, is that part of your field? And why aren't we dealing with first quarter numbers? We've got that behind us by 3 weeks.
Yeah, so this is a funny one. Again, just imagine, you know, if you are the Bureau of Economic Analysis and you're supposed to report on what the most recent quarter's total economic activity is, you know, the U.S. economy is extraordinarily complex, and it involves obviously hundreds of millions of individuals, many millions of jobs. And so the reality is, and we report various components of GDP, and so when they release the most recent quarter's numbers, they actually call it the first estimate. And so even right now, the most recent quarterly data that we have is only an estimate. And then that will get revised when they, a quarter later, when they announce the next quarter's first estimate, they revise the previous quarter. And those revisions can actually go back, you know, a year or more. And so, again, there is a certain lag just because of what a difficult job it is to measure something as complex as the U.S. economy. And so, in many cases, we are, you know, even something like the first quarter's number, you know, it can be a forecast even after an event has happened, right, where we're still trying to forecast what just happened in the recent past because the data is not out yet.
What do you think about this idea that regions are trying to coordinate with each other? You've got Washington and Oregon and the northwest area of the country trying to coordinate how
with
they're
California.
Going to reopen with California.
Yeah.
And you know, we also see it in New England, and we see it in the mid-Atlantic states. Does that make sense? I mean, somebody said,
sure.
I think that this quote really touched me, is that somebody said one state opening and one state staying closed is kind of like a designated peeing area in a swimming pool. You know, do we, you know, and there's certain, as crude as that is, there's a certain amount of logic to that, right? That people, I lived in New Jersey, I spent as much time in New York as I did in New Jersey. So you think that's the right approach? We should do regional coordination?
Sure, yeah.
All this?
Yep. Yeah. I think I would emphasize the other side of the equation, though, which is that the collaboration actually means that I would guess they're sharing information. Mm-hmm. They're actually sharing a decision-making process, which means that they're that there's more minds working on the problem. They're sharing results as they learn what the impact of a policy decision is. And so, of course, I think that coordination is great.
Well, let me also ask you, I'm sorry, Maria, let me ask you, since you're not up for re-election, and you don't serve any liability with this, when do you think we should start opening? Do you think it's coming in before May 1st?
Well, so we actually sort of in our most recent report sort of highlight May 1st as a potential turning point in the economic impact. And that's really, we fear that if these shelter-in-place orders extend well into May, that what we're actually going to see is a second contraction. So there will be the contraction that happens because we've closed the economy. But again, even during the closure, many businesses are paying employees, are paying their mortgages, or paying the rent on the building. But we actually fear that as we get deeper into May with these shelter-in-place orders, we may actually start to see small businesses go bankrupt, even with the support from the federal government. One of the things we note in the report is a 2016 survey by the J.P. Morgan Chase Institute, and they surveyed 600,000 small businesses. And in that survey, they learned that fewer than half of small businesses hold a cash buffer large enough to endure a 30-day shutdown. And so we fear that if we May 15th, which is the current date that where I am here in coastal California, may be too late. If we go as far as June 1st, then we would really expect small businesses to really run into a wall. And so we sort of see May 1st around there as a time that gives many small businesses a fighting chance.
Wow.
Well, you know, I have to say I ran a small business for 25 years, and I think it was very typical in that we went from payday to payday, and I used to have a sign over my desk, a famous economic quote from a University of Chicago economist that said, in the long run, we're all dead. You know, and that really is the mantra of small business, is it not? That you know, if you're General Motors or Cargill Grain Company or somebody like that, maybe you can plan for 10 years in advance or a year in advance. But most small businesses, they go, you know, from next week or next month or next season. They really don't go much further than that. So I'm sure that's true. I think we are certainly here in between the proverbial rock and a hard place with this. But we're starting to run out of time here, Doctor. So let me ask you, if people that want to learn more about this, because I think you have a really interesting perspective on this, how do they get a hold of SERP? Is there a website or something else they can plug into?
Sure. Yes. Thanks for asking, Senator. So the organization is CERF, C-E-R-F, the Center for Economic Research and Forecasting at California Lutheran University. Our website is www.cluserf.org, so C-L-U-C-E-R-F.org. On the webpage, you can learn about the Forecast Center and about our credentials. And there's a blog. If you click on the blog link, we've actually made much of the content of the most recent forecast publication public. And so you can read about our analysis, about the actual forecast scenarios, about our analysis of the stimulus package, and also there's an essay there about the relationship between monetary policy and stock prices. So I really encourage people to visit the blog, cluserf.org, visit the blog. And then, of course, you can also find my email there and tell me what I'm getting wrong.
Okay.
I want to ask you before we close. First of all, Dr. Phenup, thank you for your time and for your expertise and your wisdom. But SERF, you have been not only county, state, but national with your forecasting, and not just business like the Wall Street Journal and CNN Money, the Washington Post, by the way, Michael, but you've also done outlooks about home prices, jobs, and the presidential election. Do you have anything to say about that?
Oh, goodness.
About the presidential election.
Well, I think that the presidential election, so first of all, I could not have predicted, I would have predicted the incorrectly the outcome of the last election, and this one seems even more uncertain, so the whole thing's taken on a life of its own, and so I don't dare go there.
Okay. Well, I just thought maybe you had a finger in the wind.
It shows how smart you are, Doctor. And thank you so much.
To bob and weave and dodge.
Yes, exactly. That's the mantra of the politician. So we thank you for being on. We hope that you remain safe and healthy and able to acquire enough baking soda to keep you and your children happy. And we hope you'll come back again as this progresses and we have more to, more understanding, I hope.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Thank you so much. And yes, staying
so
healthy and safe.
Me.
Yes,
appreciate
your time. Thank you. We always want to thank our listeners, too, because we know you have lots of choices out there, and we're honored that you choose to make time for us, either live as we are every Sunday or available to download and listen on demand thereafter. And we're going to supply Dr. Phenup with a copy of the link for this broadcast so that you can post it on your website if you so choose to.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Maria. And as always, we leave you with the song. And, you know, I found so many songs that dealt with the economy, but I decided we would go with comfort food for everybody. So here's one from the Drifters called Money Honey. See you next week.
Yes.
Tell me what was on his mind. He said,
representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.